This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Crystal Call Magellit, Chief Executive Officer of FJ Management. Most of the listening audience has heard of FJ Management's predecessor company, Flying J. In the early 2000s, Flying J was one of the nation's largest chains of travel plazas and fuel stops. In fact, at its peak, Flying J was ranked by Forbes as one of the 20 largest privately held companies in the entire United States. But like most businesses, results do not always track neatly up and to the right. More often than not, companies experience bumps in the road, and Flying J is no exception. Within the course of a few years, Flying J had to navigate two horrific setbacks. First, the unexpected death of its founder, Jay Call, who passed away in a small plane crash. Then a few years later, the company itself faced a near-death experience in bankruptcy when the financial crisis of 2008 caused credit to dry up and crude oil prices to plunge from $100 a barrel to under $50. Join us this morning to hear how Crystal Call Magellit and her team at Flying J developed a strategy to bring Flying J back to financial health, create enormous value for its shareholders, and save thousands of jobs along the way. Crystal, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thank you.
So let's start with the origins of the company. Your father, Jay, started in the gas station business in 1965. And people think of Flying J as a Utah-based company. But actually, his first fuel station was in Oregon, and the second one was in Idaho. Why gas stations? Why do you think your father chose to go into that business?
I'm actually going to back up a little bit, way back to 1928, when my dad's uncle, Roll Call, started a station. I'm not exactly sure where that station was, somewhere in Wyoming, probably close to Afton, Wyoming. And he, I believe, when gas stations were not very prevalent, got the idea to start building gas stations. His brother, younger brother, Osborne, who is my dad's father, kind of followed suit. And my dad's, my grandfather did auto dealerships and then some service stations. And in 1960, well, even like 59, my dad went to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and he ran a very small Jay's Cut Rate, he called it. And he basically would discount fuel and not be like a major, oil company, and he could charge a lot less. So he developed this whole strategy of charging less than the major oil companies. In 1960, my parents got married at the ripe old age of 18 and 20, my mom 18, my dad 20, and they moved to Willard, Utah, where my dad eventually was able to purchase from his father a Maverick, because my grandfather and his brother had been building these stations, and the one thing they did together is name them the same thing, Maverick. My grandfather and his brother decided to merge in 1964 and formed Caribou Four Corners, which is the predecessor to Maverick as we know it today. 6 months later, my grandfather died of a massive heart attack at the age of 47, and my dad was 24. My dad went to work with his uncle for about 4 years, and loved the idea, had always been in the fuel business, obviously. Didn't particularly like working under that scenario because my father was very entrepreneurial. The Calls are in general entrepreneurial. And so he decided he would go to the West Coast. We didn't compete with his uncle's business and his family. Our family had a minority interest in the business in Caribou Four Corners. So my dad, who was an avid pilot, would get in his plane on Monday and he would fly to Washington, Oregon, California, and he started building self-service stations, which was very unique in the late 60s. He was a pioneer in self-service stations, is where he got his original, started the company, or from that convenience stores. And
So take us back, you know, I was born in 64, so I'm 52 years old. Take us back to what the fueling business was like in the 60s. One of the things I was struck as I was researching for the interview was your father chose to open two fueling stations in two different states as opposed to maybe 30 miles down the road. Why do you think he didn't choose to kind of get a concentration in a geographical area?
You know, I don't know the true answer from his head, so I'm going to be guessing. But the bottom line is that he was a pilot. and my dad liked to jump in his plane like it was a car. And I don't think there's much more sophisticated answer than that, because I think he probably landed somewhere or had been somewhere or drove somewhere and saw an opportunity. And he was buying fuel at the time from wherever, you know, a refinery, or probably not at that time even a refinery. He was probably buying it through a third party who bought it from a refinery. So he probably didn't care at the moment or think about clustering them together at that point. It was probably much more about where he saw the opportunity. And it was an excuse to go flying. There's no doubt about it.
I share that passion with your father. Oh, nice. I'm a pilot as well. So I understand that looking for a business reason to use your airplane is
a good
incentive.
Yes.
So, you know, let's go back in time. And I want to remind the audience that, you know, when you look at the 50s, when you look at the 60s, the interstate highway system was really one of the disruptive technologies in the country. And it started in the 50s, right about the time your father got, before your father got into the business, but it really took many years, states, a long period of time to fully build out the highway system. In fact, I-80 was not completed until the mid-80s, and the last stretch of that took place here in Salt Lake City. So when you look at that disruption that took place, the interstate highways, Flying J, your father decided to incorporate Flying J, and in my notes it says it was incorporated for the purpose of building and operating live-in self-service gas stations. What is a live-in self-service gas station?
So a live-in self-service gas station, which he was building on the West Coast, basically was a cinder block building with a bedroom and a window. And my dad figured out a mechanism, nothing nearly as technical as what we use today, that someone could stay in their home and flip a switch to change the fuel pump back to zeros. They'd have to come to the window and pay. And my father hired retired people to come and live in these cinder block buildings and run the station. It was a great business for them. My guess is I'm pretty sure he gave them a share of the profits. And they were so cheap to build that he could actually build one, have the credit from the fuel, make the money to go build the next one. He had great working capital. And that's how he built these 30-some-odd self-service stations on
now,
the West Coast.
In today's world, the biggest challenge with building a fueling station is all the environmental issues that you have to deal with. What was it like back then? Could you literally just put a holding tank underground that was good enough?
I think it probably was. Based on the things we see today that were done, that we live with in our industry, I believe that's about how easy it probably was.
Interesting. So I know I mentioned the mid-80s. It was 86 that I-80 was completed right here in Salt Lake City. Also in 86, your father purchased his first refinery, the holdings of Husky Limited. Why was it important to your dad to own a refinery?
So actually, the first refineries were purchased in 1981, called Thunderbird. Husky was a much bigger refinery and a real refinery. But I believe my dad was truly an entrepreneur, and he was always looking for opportunity. And I believe he thought there would be opportunity in being a fully integrated oil company. And what I mean by that, which we were by 1981 with the acquisition of Thunderbird, we not only had retail, we had the trucks, we then had exploration production, refining. We had the whole integrated oil company. Very small, but the whole integrated oil company. Now, granted, even with the Husky acquisition, which was around 25 truck stops, and we had embarked on the truck stop industry in 1979 when we opened Ogden. What we called Travel Plaza, we always called the truck stops Travel Plaza. We didn't want to be associated with, to your point, what was on the interstate at that point, which were dirty and people didn't, you know, the traveling public wouldn't want to stop there. And my dad felt this desire to create a clean spot for truckers, too. But along those lines, going back to your original question about the refineries, we could never, as we were building retail facilities, have serviced all of the retail facilities from the few refineries we had. So I believe it was a lot more about what was an opportunity and just the industry that my dad was comfortable in. And I believe that Husky had a lot more to do with the 25 truck stops that came with it as the refinery.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Crystal Call Magellan, CEO and President of Flying J FJ Management, Inc. So the whole idea of a refinery, I don't know if you followed in the news 5 or 6 years ago, Delta Airlines decided to purchase a refinery. And the whole idea is strategy. And, you know, does it make sense for an airline to own a refinery? I would argue in your case, being integrated oil, you can make a closer tie to that. You went to Harvard Business School. Michael Porter's there, you know, famous strategist. What do you think, with the benefit of hindsight, does it make sense for a fuel stop business to own all of the assets, or is that something that there's plenty of gasoline supply out there where maybe you don't need to own the supply?
I think that you don't need to own the supply. It's nice to own the supply if you are lucky enough to have the sort of centralization to use your own supply, but in the end, they're two very different businesses. And it's not, you know, and you've seen through the years, who knows how many times you've seen major oil companies buy their own retail assets and then sell them again and buy them and sell them. And so I think that that's an unknown a little bit, but from my perspective, because it's really how I was brought up, we always operated our businesses very independent of one another. So in other words, our refinery business operated separately from our trucking companies. You know, we had synergies, the back office, but as far as the bottom line and sales teams and things like that, we really felt it was much more beneficial to operate them independently because you had outside customers. You know, the refinery wasn't selling all the fuel to our own facilities. And we also wanted to be very market driven. So I think it isn't necessarily a great business model. It's okay, but it's not necessary by any means.
Yeah, they're very different businesses, you
very
point
different
out.
Businesses.
My undergrad's in engineering, and I worked for British Petroleum for a number of years, including when you guys bought Husky. I was paying my way through college by working every other semester and worked at the Marcus Hook Refinery in Pennsylvania. And it is very different. I mean, safety is the number one concern.
Right. It's a manufacturing plant.
It's a manufacturing
and retail
plant.
Is a, you know, consumer. It's a refinery is business to business. Retail's business to consumer. I mean, you can't really make many things. They're not the same. They're
now,
very different.
Now, talk to me about your dad's desire to keep the business units separate. I mean, that's in vogue now for a lot of good reasons. Was not so popular back in the 80s when there were these mega corporations taking place. What was it that your father thought he benefited from by keeping the units separate?
I think that he was worried that you wouldn't have true market price. So in other words, the refinery might not get the true value of what the refinery could get if you fully integrated everything. So you by not doing that, the retail facilities were being priced correctly, the fuel from the refineries were being market priced, and there wasn't this problem where you might get off whack with your intercompany pricing that would cause you to not be as profitable because you did that.
So were the travel plazas, the fuel stops, free to buy gas from whoever they wanted, including Husky was one of the options?
They would have been encouraged, yes, to buy across the country to look at the pricing, or at least, you know, we had a supply and distribution department supplying the truck stops, and that supply and distribution would likely go to the refinery and say, look, we're not paying. We'll buy the fuel from you, but this is the going price. We're not going to pay you more than that.
Well, your father was ahead of his time, ahead of his time, and it sounds like it worked out really well for you. Your father was also a deal maker. In 1991, Flying J and Conoco entered a joint venture that enabled significant expansion to the travel plazas. What was that partnership? And I can see where it lined up fuel, but how did it enable an expansion of the travel plazas?
Well, the travel plazas were very expensive to build. Brick and mortar is always expensive. And in the day, in the early 90s, it was probably $7 or $8 million to build a travel plaza. And the management at Flying J, along with my dad, had big ideas. They had, this was a great opportunity to build these truck stops, travel plazas across the country. And in order to do it quickly and expedite a plan, they needed a partner. And at the time, diesel fuel was, it was hard for the big majors to get rid of diesel fuel. And so it was a great partnership. But as the story goes, my dad wrote letters to all the majors and said, hey, we're going to build this network of truck stops. We'll have a big need for diesel. Is anybody interested? And Conoco was the only one that replied. And that was an amazing partnership for many, many years with ConocoPhillips, because we, they, again, talking about what we were talking about a few minutes ago, that some of the majors didn't want to be in the retail business, but they needed an outlet for their fuel, and it was a great marriage with Conoco.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Crystal Call Magellit, CEO and President of FJ Management. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Crystal Call Magellit, CEO and President of FJ Management. So Crystal, let's go to your story now. So before break, we were talking about the Conoco partnership in the mid-90s. You were just graduating undergrad. You were starting Harvard Business School. Tell us, what was it like growing up in your family?
Wow, that is a good question. I think growing up in my family, all I saw was entrepreneurship. My mom actually was a franchisor for Diet Center, which was a diet business back in the mid-80s into the early 90s. She was building a business in Texas. I saw my dad building this oil business. And so in my house, entrepreneurship was just all there was. And so as I was going to business school, I actually worked at American Express for a summer just to see what corporate America was like, and I said, I can't stand this. So I knew even then in my mid to late 20s that I needed to be involved in our family business in some way, but I didn't really know how to get involved in it. At that point, Flying J was, I'm sure, over $2 billion in sales and had thousands of employees, and so at that point, I was just looking for ways to be in business and really just looking for opportunities in the early to mid-90s.
And I know several years after business school, you and your father started the Crystal Hotel chain. Was that your first entrepreneurial venture?
Yes, the Crystal Inns were definitely my first true entrepreneurial experience and gave me exactly that. My dad was, even though he was an entrepreneur, he definitely surrounded himself with smart people and then he let them do their jobs. And that's really the key to why Flying J, in my opinion, grew. And so I knew that by then. And so when he approached me and said there was land in Salt Lake City, and he knew that he had a friend that he was a silent partner on a limited service hotel that was working great in Oregon, and did I want to come back to Utah from the East Coast and start a hotel? I knew that it would be my baby to start, and I knew that my dad would not butt in and he'd be there to help, and that's exactly how that played out. And I met my husband really the same weekend, another Harvard graduate, but we met at a wedding. We'd graduated, and we met at a wedding a year after graduation, and he ended up, we got married, he came to Utah with me, and we launched our own business at Crystal Inn, and over a 10-year period of time, ended up with 14 hotels, most built from the ground up, but we also took on the management of the few lodging properties that Flying J had acquired along the way.
So you mentioned one of your father's strengths was surrounding himself with smart people and giving them the freedom to do their jobs well. That's often a hard skill to learn. What was your experience like at Crystal Inn? Were you able to immediately entrust people fully? It was probably very important to you that this first venture succeed, which makes it even harder to give people that freedom.
You know, I think I needed help so badly because it was my first entrepreneurial endeavor, and because I had seen that model by my dad and it had worked, that I was extremely trusting and bringing people on. And didn't have too much of a problem. Of course, I got burned a few times, and history would show I've been burned many times by trusting people, but I still,
to this day. That's
what
makes it hard, right? I mean, just getting real. That's what's hard about it. I mean, if people step up and do a great job, it's easy to do it.
Exactly.
The reality is the team that works for you has similar strengths and skills as you and occasionally drops the ball. And it's really hard when you're on the line when somebody else drops the ball.
That's right. And I definitely, that's a trait that I continue to have, to want to trust people and give people opportunities. And my guess is, even though I have been burned several times by that, I can't get over wanting to trust people and believing in people that they'll do a great job.
So you grew up in this family business that, right about the time you started Crystal Inn, was being ranked by Forbes magazine as one of the 20 largest privately held companies in the United States. You're the daughter of the founder. That gives you some advantages in the hotel business. It also gives you some disadvantages. Talk about both of those, if you would.
Well, the very interesting thing is, luckily for me, I believe I've always been a very confident person. And I came to Salt Lake to build the first Crystal Inn, and I hit the ground running because I was doing the marketing, I was working with the builders, I was doing everything, and I was very, very busy. But rumor had it, later I found out that my dad had given me the hotel for my engagement present, that, you know, there's no way that this woman could come and just launch a hotel with having no experience at all. Those were the kind of a little bit negatives, but in a way they weren't negatives because they really lit fire under me to show people that I could be my own person. And even though I was Jay Call's daughter, just watch what I can accomplish. And so for me, it was really more of a motivator to come from someone like that. I always wanted to do better, I guess, or I don't know if that's even
that's
fair.
That's a tough benchmark. When your dad builds one of the 20 largest privately held companies in the world, that's one of the challenges, right,
it is.
Of growing up
it
in
is.
A family like
it
that.
It is. It's a big challenge in growing up in a family like that, and it, I think, can look very overwhelming. So sometimes you have to look other ways to be successful. And for instance, in my case, like you said, I had not been to college, or my father had not been to college. So to go on and get a business degree from Harvard Business School, in my eyes, I could look and differentiate myself from my father in that way, which is very different than a financial goal. And I think that's still how I feel today as I look at my children and how much pressure there is in this family business. I look to, well, what else could they do to be successful so that they don't have to experience quite as much pressure? Or how can I create or help them, not even create, how can I help them come up with opportunities that they can be successful, because there's tons of things out there to do, right? But it is a lot of, there is a big responsibility, I call it a responsibility and stewardship to family business that exists, and it puts a lot of pressure. And yes, I felt that pressure even back in the day when Flying J was.
And your biggest test was not the Crystal Inn. Your biggest test, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit, came during the financial crisis, during the bankruptcy, and saving this family business from what many people thought was unsavable. So kudos to you. We're going to come back to that. You mentioned you worked in the summer for American Express that let you know that you didn't want to work for corporate America. What other career experiences did you have? You graduated from Pepperdine. I imagine there were a couple years before you went to Harvard Business School. What did you do during that period of time?
So I graduated from Pepperdine, and I came back. This is kind of a funny story. I graduated early. I graduated in 3.5 years, and so I graduated in December. And I came back to Utah, and I had no idea. Again, I came from an entrepreneurial world. I had no idea how to get a job, and I was off track at a college graduating December when career fairs and resume building and all those things. So I came back to Salt Lake, and I kind of believed it was my right to just take a few months off, and I was kind of looking for jobs. And one day, and this is the only time this ever happened, my dad called me up in the spring, and he said, "There's a job for you Monday morning at Flying J." So at the time, Flying J was in Brigham City,
Utah. Your dad decided vacation was over
for
you, huh? That's
right. That's right. So I went to work at Flying J, and that is where I worked for 3 years. I worked in the refining division buying and selling LPG products and moving rail cars around. And then I did grand openings and the marketing side for the truck stops. And that was my only day-to-day experience at Flying J for about 3 years before I went back to business school.
So growing up in the family business, your dad's an entrepreneur, your mom's an entrepreneur. But as a kid, sometimes you hear stories about how kids worked in the business as they were growing up. That was not your experience.
No, it wasn't, because I went to my dad when I was 16 and I said, you know, I really want to go work at one of the convenience stores or truck stops. And even though my brother, who's 2 years older, was doing that, he said, no, I don't really think that's the right thing for you to do. And so I went and got a job at McDonald's instead at that point.
That is awesome. How did that make you feel that your dad said, okay, your brother's working in the business, but you can't work in the business?
You know, I understood that he was being protective of his daughter. You know, it didn't make me feel too bad. I did kind of understand, and maybe I was even a little afraid too. So it maybe felt more comfortable to go to McDonald's, but it's made for a great story since. But I think I didn't view it. I think I viewed it that he loved me, and he viewed his daughter as not being, you know, as capable standing up to the truckers as his son. And, you know, I don't necessarily like that, but I understand it was his love and protective.
Well, as the father of two teenage daughters now, I very much understand that need to want to protect. My daughter works in a local, where I live up in Park City, works in a local restaurant. And, you know, Dad wanted to see if I could hook her up with a job in a research lab at the University of Utah and do some of these things that dads can do when they have friends that are doing interesting stuff. But it's also good. I'm glad to hear you went to work at McDonald's, because it's good for you to have that experience as well.
Yes, definitely.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Crystal Call-Magellit, CEO and President of FJ Management, Inc. So I mentioned before break about your biggest challenge was still to face you. Crystal Inn was a challenge. You opened a number of chains. I still see the one here in Salt Lake City. I understand they're doing quite well. So you face that challenge well, and it's a good thing that you had that experience. Because Flying J was about to enter some pretty tough years. I mentioned in the open in 2003, in a rural part of Idaho, your father passed away. Actually, I think I've got the dates wrong here. But in 2003, you were 38 years old. Sorry, I didn't mean to tell your age. The company sales were $4.6 billion. You know, what... Your father, oh, he did die in 2003.
He did, March of 2003.
I'm sorry, my notes are a little messed up here. What happened then? I mean, I imagine you're running Crystal Inn. This is your father, so it's a huge, you know, and that's number one. But when you move on, now all of a sudden, what's going on with the company? That had to be a very big concern for your mom and for you.
Yeah, so in 2003, we had basically were involved with Crystal Inn, but I was not even as involved with Crystal Inn, because from 1993 to 2000, not only did we build hotels, we also had four children. So in 2003, I had four kids that were 3 to 8 years old when my father passed away. And my dad he was 62, almost 63, and he had really turned the reins of Flying J over to a young executive that was 11 years older than I was and had been running the company for 10 or 15 years. And so my dad was not, from my view, running Flying J day to day, and hadn't been for a number of years when he passed away. So it was terrible to lose my father, but I felt like the company was still in very good hands. My dad had definitely groomed me that the leadership team, who had been there for many, many years, were seasoned executives, and I had complete faith that Flying J would continue on. I was on the board. I had been on the board of Flying J since I was 18 years old, and I did, even before my dad died, we would meet on a monthly basis. They had a management meeting that they would have all the division heads come to and talk about what they're doing, and I made it a practice to go to that meeting. And I also, we put in place that each division would meet with us once a year, their extended management teams, for an hour. And so I knew quite a bit about Flying J from from a very high level, luckily. In 2003, I added that I would meet with the president. My brother and I would go meet with the president. And we decided, my brother's 2 years older, had older children. We decided my brother would be chairman of the board. And at that point, and really life went on. And it really went on because Flying J, when you say it was $4 billion in 2003, in 2008, it was $20 billion. So those 5 years,
tremendous growth.
Tremendous growth.
Tremendous growth, but not without risk as well. So growth on the revenue side, not as much growth in the articles I've read. On the profitability side, which can work when the economy is doing well, it can really bite you quickly when the economy turns around. So not only were you in the Travel Plaza business at that point, but you had expanded the refinery business, were also in the pipeline business, so really becoming a fully diversified oil company, much like a small Exxon or Chevron
right.
would be. It takes a lot of capital to be a small Exxon or Chevron. And unfortunately, 2008 happened. And when 2008 happened, not only did oil prices drop from $100 a barrel to under 50, but credit dried up. And if you were a public company and could access the public markets, maybe you could navigate that. But there's payments that need to be made on a regular basis, just as a backdrop for the audience. And there's financings that are constantly being done to pay down old debt and reestablish new debt. And that works until you don't have access to new debt. And now all of a sudden you've got to pay off the debt that's maturing, but you don't have access to the debt markets. I'm speculating here, but from the outside, I suspect that was the credit crunch you guys found yourself in.
Yes, and you mentioned in the introduction, but to top all that and make the perfect storm would be oil falling from 140 down to $30 a barrel when you have huge inventories of fuel across the country.
You know, ironically, absolutely, because you own a lot of oil. There's a lot of
yes.
oil in that pipeline. There's a lot of oil at the fuel station. So the value of that oil goes down. So you get
you might have paid the 140, and now
it's... Now, here's the funny thing. I have some friends that own several fueling locations, and I've asked them, would you rather own your fueling location when the prices are going up and the prices are going down? Now, these are smaller adjustments.
Right, right.
But they tell me they make more money when oil goes down because the local gas station doesn't lower the prices quickly on the way down as they raise it on the way up. Why did that not work somewhat in your favor when prices were coming down?
Because we were a fully integrated oil company. So yes, it did work in our favor, as you described, on the retail side. But on the refining side, we had two pretty big refineries. Well, they're small in big scheme of things, but big enough refineries. And we had a pipeline full of finished product. And, you know, those inventories, along with our debt, were a problem.
So this is a big, big challenge that even very experienced CEOs that have the full faith of their team, have been in place for decades, this is a big challenge for anybody. You let the president and CEO of the company go because of this focus on expansion, on revenue, while not being as concerned as in hindsight everybody would have liked him to have been on the profitability. I believe you take over as the president and CEO.
But it wasn't quite in that order. The bankruptcy, we filed for Chapter 11, and I had been groomed to believe in the executive team. And when I brought outsiders in, I needed a lot of help to maneuver a bankruptcy the size of the bankruptcy.
Plus, you guys at the time were an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan, right? So a lot of which complicates
20%,
things.
80% family owned at the time, roughly
20%
ESOP.
Owned by the employees,
right.
Which complicates things
yes.
as well.
Yes, definitely. Makes for a lot more sad families, would be the way I would put it.
It does, and it puts tremendous pressure on you and your brother now.
Yes.
So talk to us about those days. How did you come up with a game plan? How did you get consensus? How did you get confidence that the new game plan stood a good chance of working?
The good news was that a lot of our businesses were still, even in the recession days, doing very, very well. So the fact, and you pointed this out, that we owed lots of money for crude oil and things like that, and the line was drawn in the sand. Bankruptcy worked for us like bankruptcy is designed to work, which means the line was drawn in the sand, and as long as we could operate on our cash flows going forward, we had operating ongoing businesses. Now, that was even a little tricky. Our partners, Conoco, stepped up to help us with a bit of credit on fuel, or I can't say that I'd be sitting here today, because we had to be able to operate our retail facilities and keep crude oil coming into our refinery, because all of a sudden we had to pay for everything cash up front. So it was a difficult time, definitely, but I could see, it was very clear, the restructure was very clear. There were businesses that were losing money, and there were businesses that were making money. And I knew I needed to get rid of the businesses that were losing money and keep the businesses that were making money, which is exactly what I went about trying to achieve. My biggest goal out of the gate was to pay people back. My second goal was to keep as many jobs as I could. And that was where I started from. I was naive, probably. I'm glad I was naive. I had no idea that later we would pay $1.8 billion back to people. I thought
we were... In fact, you ended up paying back every dime that was owed.
Plus interest.
And it usually doesn't happen. Big congratulations on that.
It doesn't usually happen, but if I was going to continue doing business, that was the way I viewed it needed to happen.
Now, a critique of MBAs, I'm an MBA, so I've heard this critique of myself and my peers as well, is you have to be careful or you can suffer from analysis paralysis. Were you at risk of that? And if so, how did you overcome it?
I was never at risk of that because I am not a very analytical person. So I married my husband for that. That's the role he plays. He's an engineer and we've always worked very closely together in the hotels and at FJ Management, not during the bankruptcies much, but all the other times. And I always say he's that side, but I'm not a very analytical person. And I think that for me, the restructure environment is probably where I was at my best because I was okay at having people come in and tell me things and again, trusting them and believing in them and being able to make decisions very quickly.
Well, let me just lay the backdrop though, because by being okay and trusting folks, in part, that's what got Flying J into
that's
this
exactly
situation.
Right.
So I would think it would be really hard to say, okay, this is a different person. I'm going to fully trust that. How did you decide who you're going to trust and when you needed to take the numbers home? You said you're not analytical and you and your husband go over the numbers and make the decision with more scrutiny.
You know, I think the good news is that we hired very smart legal team out of Chicago, Kirkland & Ellis, and we had Blackstone was our investment bank. I had a lot of people on my side that were really smart that even though they were outside professionals, I felt like I could trust them. I felt like they knew they could navigate. They were bankruptcy attorneys, right, and investment bankers, and I could tell they could navigate the waters, and I trusted them on that. There was a lot of people watching over us too, and I knew that, right? Creditors committees formed, they had their outside advisors. So I was not ever alone in these. I didn't have the ability under bankruptcy to make independent decisions. So really what I had to do is collaborate and convince to do the plans that
which
I
in
thought
some
would
ways
work.
I would argue makes
plus,
it harder.
Plus ConocoPhillips was our partner and they were not particularly happy with us. They weren't upset with me, but they weren't particularly happy with us. So
which
that was another
party. Which makes it even
party.
Harder
yes.
to do all this. Because
yes.
not only do you have to decide what the right path is, but then you have to build consensus.
Yes.
And you have parties that have very different interests. Talk to us about building consensus. You guys owed a lot of money.
Yes.
There's a saying, if you're going to go into bankruptcy, you'd rather owe hundreds of millions as opposed to millions or tens of millions. But everybody's got different interests. How did you build consensus to come up with a single game plan?
I think in the beginning, it was really just appealing. The creditors were the first place I needed to go, right? Because for me to be able to have any control at all about what's going to happen, I needed those creditors committees to be at least okay with me. I needed to build trust from them. And so the first thing I did out of the gate, really, was to go meet with the creditors committee. And it was hard and it was scary. And say, I intend to pay people back. And that's what I'm going to do. Now, they'd heard that before, right? And everybody in the bankruptcy world had heard that before. And I'm sure behind closed doors, it was like, she's either really stupid or naive, or, you know, she might seem a little sincere, but that just can't happen. So I had to do a few things. Like, the first thing that I think probably created some people looking and saying, oh, maybe she really means it, is our exploration production company was a small part of our business and it was doing fine. And the creditors wanted me to sell it. And I threw them that bone. That was the business that I wouldn't have wanted to sell. It supplied some oil to our refinery in Salt Lake. And the creditors really were like, well, show us you mean what you say. So that was I could throw that out there and I could say, I will put these businesses that are losing money up for sale right away, like out of the gate. I'm not going to put the North Salt Lake refinery up for sale. I'm not going to put the Travel Plaza business up for sale. I will sell exploration and production, and we're operating on our cash flows. Give me some time. I'm going to figure this out. So you had these three sales processes going on, which was taking the time of the creditors, and they know, they could see that I was walking the walk. They could see that I really, truly was trying to do the best I could. I was very transparent and open and communicated with all the parties as best I could. I would never run and hide. I believed very early on, I knew very early on, I would be asked so many things, that I had to be honest, even if it was hard to be honest, because the only way I was going to remember what I'd said to this person or that person is by being honest. So I could not sugarcoat things, whether it's an employee or a creditors committee or another executive. The only way I knew that I could be upfront and honest, it was exactly that, which was key. All those things came together for me.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Crystal Call Magellit, CEO and President of FJ Management. Very difficult to do what you did. As you say, not only did you pay back all the money that was owed plus interest, you also saved thousands of jobs along the way, which really just shows the importance of this type of work. You were under the gun. You stepped up to the moment. Oftentimes, some of our biggest challenges are scariest points in life. In hindsight, you look back and they really define who you are and create a wonderful experience for you. And I'm glad it worked out that way. And I know for sure your employees and your creditors are glad it worked out that way.
Most of them. But, you know, there is wreckage along the way and that makes you feel bad, you know. And not every single job was saved. And there are sacrifices. People did make sacrifices and helped along the way. It definitely wasn't me. I had a ton of support, right? I was leading the charge, but there are so many people behind the scenes.
What would you tell a young entrepreneur that followed his or her dream, built something, took on some debt to fund growth, and you know what, it didn't work out, and now they find themselves facing bankruptcy? What are two or three nuggets you would share with that person how to handle that bankruptcy process?
I think the first is, like I said a minute ago, you've got to be honest with your situation. You can't try to sugarcoat it. You've got to tell it like it is and be extremely transparent. Because if you're not, and you lose trust, you're just going to be out of there and you'll have no chance of saving anything, because just bankruptcy itself, there's vultures everywhere. And you've got to have all the parties aligned to make that happen. And then, you know, march forward. Don't look in the mirror and say, I'm a failure. Be able to pick yourself up and learn from that endeavor. But to me, you still need to make it right with all the parties involved as best you can. I mean, I have people even today that'll be like, well, that's great, you paid everybody back, but why would you do that? It's like, well, because that was the right thing to do. Like, to me, there was no other choice. But there are a lot of people out there
to at least try.
Some people can't always do it. But I really believed we could do it. So I wasn't short of, to the last bitter end, not being able to do that. It was way important. And I think the approach, you know, if you go into bankruptcy with the approach of, well, I'm just going to get this company back for pennies on the dollar, but I'm still going to control it. That's that's not right.
So, you know, one of the tough decisions you had to make, you sold the unprofitable businesses. Those were difficult. They were in the family business for many years. I suspect one of the biggest challenges was the merger with Pilot Travel Centers. You guys had 270 travel centers when you did the merger. And probably the toughest point here is after that deal, Pilot retained a majority ownership of the merged company. How did you go about deciding if that was the right move or not?
Well, it really was a simple old-fashioned business deal where Jimmy Haslam, who owned Pilot, his family owned Pilot, and he was the CEO, he had been trying to meet with me. I mean, all the owner's competitors called me within the first couple of weeks of bankruptcy in late December, early January, because they all knew, you know, can I help you? Can I help you? Jimmy was no different, and he
I'm
he
glad that's why they were calling. I thought they were calling to try to pick up a deal.
So. Yeah, well, but, you know, anyway, he was on that list. You know, he kept calling. But we were in a lawsuit with Pilot at the time, and I had been taught to really, and they were the competition. So I was, and when I talked trust, we talked a lot of trust. I didn't have a lot of trust there for no good reason other than they were our competition. And we're in a lawsuit. So it took a while. But eventually, Jimmy is a relentless entrepreneurial business guy. And when he wants something, he goes after it. And he was no different in pursuing something, working together. So he flew into Salt Lake. We met what was then the Metropolitan Restaurant. We met there, paper tablecloth. And he started telling me, and this is June, so I've been CEO for 6 months. I've been working with ConocoPhillips. I have a really strong understanding of low-hanging fruit within our retail business that we could do a lot better if we would change certain things. ConocoPhillips won't work with me on those things. Jimmy Haslam comes in. He's been in this business 35 years. He can tell me exactly what he would do if these two companies are merged together. I know I haven't been in this business day-to-day for 35 years, and this merged company is going to be amazing. He tells me he probably doesn't want, well, in the beginning, we were going to merge the whole company. On our next meeting, neither of us wanted. I didn't want to sell the refinery. He didn't want the refinery. So every step of the way, once I had met with Jimmy Haslam and he understood when he'd give me the value of the company, he would keep the brand. I would have as much ownership. Not only would I have ownership out of the bankruptcy, so I only took exactly the cash. If I still had cash left over after the bankruptcy, I could invest in at the same price and get, you know, as a high percent ownership as there could be. The severance was going to be good for our employees. And to your point, I hoped I would save thousands of jobs. I knew our headquarters. Those are the people I was talking about a minute ago. You know, 200 or 300 people did lose their jobs. Some of them had opportunities in Knoxville, but that would have been hard to do. But though that's how that played out, because suddenly I saw a way that I could meet that goal of paying people back and still keep our family business and name out there.
So you learned a lot from your father. It sounds like you also learned a lot negotiating this deal with Jimmy. What did you learn about negotiations working with Jimmy?
You know, I think Jimmy really wanted this deal, and he was very much a gentleman, and he treated me very, very well. And he wasn't, I believe my dad always had, he always talked a lot about you leave somebody better off after you've done the deal. That's a good deal. And I really think Jimmy was not out there to take advantage of the situation. He was extremely fair. There's many things he could have done to make life very difficult. He never, you know, so I tried also, if you taught negotiation, I tried also to be fair with him. Again, very honest negotiations, no one trying to hide anything, the real reasons why I thought I deserved this price. And, you know, and he really wanted the company. I had that going for me. That's always good if you're negotiating with somebody that really wants something. But he saw the value. He knew he could pay a nice price and still have, which has played out, an amazing combined company.
You know, as I heard you describe the experience, what I heard was Jimmy really focusing on what was important for you And how could he get you what was important to you, your family, and your shareholders? Which I think, having done many negotiations in my life, now that's really the secret. If you can enter a negotiation and focus on what the other person wants and how can you get that for that person, boy, the majority of the time you're going to end up with a deal that's better for both parties.
That's right. And that's exactly.
And it's counterintuitive. Frankly, it's not what they teach you at Harvard or Stanford Business School. But hopefully 25 years later now they do, because it is this. I learned it actually from a local business person here in town, Joel Peterson, taught me that. And it's been a lifetime lesson. Fortunately for me, Joel taught me that 25 years ago, and I've been able to use that in my careers. But that's what I heard coming out in spades as you described
very
this.
Very much.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Crystal McCaug Magellit. She is the CEO and president of FJ Management, Inc. So let's switch gears. You did the merger with Pilot. You were able to pay back all the debt plus interest. Many, many thousands of jobs were saved. That was a nice success. And what you're doing now is you're running FJ Management. What is FJ Management?
So FJ Management is a holding company. When we came out of bankruptcy, Flying J was really a holding company, too. It held many different businesses, and so we just renamed Flying J to FJ Management because I thought Flying J was really our retail brand, and even though we were keeping, you know, many of the assets, I felt the Flying J name should go with the truck stops. So we renamed ourselves FJ Management, and in 2010, when we came out of bankruptcy, we had our merged Pilot entities and our minority ownership in that. We had Tab Bank, which is at the time an industrial bank. We had Big West Refinery, and we had TCH, which is a credit card processing company, which we owned 50% of. But in that case, kind of the control, we were controlling that. We owned it with Pilot, but we were controlling it. And then we ended up with a lot of cash, actually. As I mentioned, the creditors thought we needed a certain amount of cash, and we thought we needed a lot less. And we ended up with a huge amount of debt on Big West, our refinery, is how we were able to keep that. So that was kind of starting point of FJ Management in July of 2010. That's what it looked like. And many, many things have happened over the 6 years since then that have been very favorable to us. The refinery did very, very well. We were able to pay the debt off in a year and a half, and it continued to do quite well. The merged entity with Pilot became and is today now the seventh largest private company in the U.S. And even though we have a minority ownership, it's still an amazing business. Because of the success of our businesses, we were able 4 years ago to go back and buy Maverick, which was originally the company I talked about earlier in the program that my grandfather and uncle had together. We eventually, our side sold out in 1976, so it was very fun for my cousin to find a buyer that was still a call, and it was very nice full circle for us to be able to acquire Maverick 4 years ago. And we have, you know, had our credit card processing company merged a couple of times, and we ended up selling that company a couple of years ago, which was a very good sell. And so we've got a great business going forward. We've moved our headquarters to downtown Salt Lake from Ogden. Maverick is definitely our controlled business and an amazing platform to grow from. It's something I'm very used to, the retail petroleum business. Big West is still a big part of what we do, and our partnership with Pilot Flying J is still a huge part of what we do. We're on the board at Pilot Flying J, and our partnership with the Haslam family continues to be very strong.
So as you look at the fuel business, obviously with the purchase of Maverick in 2012, you guys are still believers in the fuel plazas, the fuel stops. You know, oftentimes technology takes longer to play out than any of us think. Bill Gates is famous for saying, people overestimate what they think is going to happen with technology in the next 5 years, but they underestimate what's going to happen in the next 15 to 20. And I've certainly seen that play out as well. One of the surprises to that axiom, though, is electric cars. I'm just, you know, the success of Tesla in the last 5 years, all of the major brands are coming out with an electric car, which is probably a good thing for us as a society. Not as good if you're in a fuel stop business. How do you look at the challenge that electric cars, electric trucks presents to your business?
I think it is a challenge. It's not as big of a challenge if we view Maverick as a convenience stop and if we have great in-store offerings. It's not as big of a challenge. It is a challenge, however. But I think if you really look at the sales of electric cars and how it's progressing, it's not really going very fast since fuel prices are low. And the infrastructure for electric cars is not very established. And people are going back to buying SUVs. Now, do I know that, is that 5 years out or 50 years out? Or, you know, I don't know how long. And I think it's, I have to be very careful. We in our industry have to be very careful to keep a very close eye on that. But the way that we are looking at it a little bit is, or not a little bit, that at Maverick, how we look at it is really making our in-store experience or creating an in-store experience that becomes much bigger than our fueling experience.
People still need to take a stop, their legs. Another challenge, unfortunately, is not only are electric cars gaining popularity more quickly than I would have thought 5 years ago, but this whole talk about autonomous vehicles is gaining momentum much quicker than I would have thought. In Pittsburgh, Uber is testing out self-driving cars. Now, by law, there has to be somebody behind the steering wheel, but the idea is the driver doesn't touch the steering wheel. And the passenger is advised not to talk to the driver because they want to see societally what does that experience feel like to be in a car where you're not speaking with the driver. In Taiwan, there's a competitor to Uber, actually a pretty small company that introduced self-driving cars in a 20-mile self-defined radius. So autonomous cars are probably coming. They're probably smarter than we are. Now, there's still going to be the passenger in the back seat reading the Wall Street Journal during the journey, and that person's going to want to stop at a truck stop. But as its name implies, the truck stops are really built around trucks. It's probably not too far away that we start seeing self-driving trucks on the highway, as scary as that probably sounds to all of us right now. How do you think about that and the impact on your business?
I think that that has potential on the truck side to be impactful. It is going to be interesting. I've actually been thinking about that a lot over the past months. And in the 1st of October, the American Trucking Association had their annual convention, and I attended it with Jimmy Haslam. We do that together. And we lined up meetings exactly on those two subjects, battery power and autonomous vehicles, with all the trucking manufacturing companies, CEOs and presidents. And we asked them, how far out is this, you know, from their perspective?
Guessing they said 3 to 5 years.
2030.
30, okay.
Between 25
and
30. So
still 15 years out.
You especially know, the autonomous. Money is... That was actually a bit surprising to me. Especially autonomous vehicles, trucks specifically, which I was surprised. I thought that may be, and again, they may be wrong, right? Who knows? I mean, 8 years ago, let's say 3-4 years ago, if people said, well, the oil industry that was booming will crash, a lot of people would have said, oh, no way, this is great. It's the first time we're domestically, you know. So I'm not saying they're right, but it's very interesting that their perspective, because they're the manufacturers, right? So they've got to create these vehicles that drive on electricity or autonomously or, you know. So they were very, they put it out there a little farther.
Do you think we as a country are elected leaders that really should be driving some of this conversation? Are we talking about the things that we should be talking about regarding the impact of this? I mean, a lot of these small towns that are 100 miles between each other on the highway, the fuel truck stop business is a big part of their economy. Do you feel that our elected officials get it, that they know that this could have a huge impact on the country? Truck driver is one of the most common jobs in the United States. People forget. I think it might be the most common job in the United States.
Which a huge infrastructure, right? And it's a huge part of everything we do every day, how things are moved from place to place. And talk about disruption if that's not how it happens. I think really what's more impactful today than electric or autonomous is the Amazon, is the last mile driven, not the long versus long haul trucking. That, to me, from my perspective and what I hear, probably has the quickest impact on the long haul trucking industry than the autonomous truck or the electric truck, because it's changing the way we shop, the way we, you know, wholesale things.
Well, let's talk about that, because FJ Management is doing investments in, you know, when your father started Flying J, there was a major disruption taking place that we all take for granted now, which was the interstate highway system. FJ Management's, one of your goals is to find that next technology, get in front of the that wave, and create the next Flying J built right. that technology is going to need. You mentioned Amazon. Thanksgiving is coming up. Last Black Friday, Amazon did 1/3 of all e-commerce sales, Black Friday, on the entire internet for U.S. buyers. That is a staggering number. And why are they able to do that? I would argue because of machine learning, big data, and AI. And it's scary because who else can catch them? There's only a handful of companies that can catch Amazon at this point. You've got Google, you've got Apple, you've got Facebook, obviously, maybe Twitter. But are we as a society comfortable with that? When your father started Flying J, the Sinclair oil monopoly had been broken up. And thank goodness, maybe your father wouldn't have been able to do what he did if that had happened. As you look at that technology landscape and the things you guys are excited about at FJ Management, what are a couple of those?
You know, I think, and this is a little bit different answer to your question, but I'm not so sure that I, within our own industry, because I didn't grow up ground up in this industry necessarily. It was around me. But I believe today and for the next several years that Maverick will be great for us to invest in if we get good at food service. I don't know that we're going to be the most high-tech person in that environment. And I think that alongside that, we actually have another investment arm of our company that's looking at other industries out of the petroleum industry that might be more growth industries. That's hard. And you hear often that diversification is not always good if you leave your core business. But I think from our perspective, that's a little bit different than the question you asked me, but that's the way. I don't claim to be, to know what to do on the petroleum side. There are so many moving pieces of who, will it be electric? Will it be natural gas? Will people, autonomous, all these things. So there'll be a lot of venture businesses and things like that through the years probably that will come and go. And when something lands and the dust settles, hopefully it will combine nicely with what we're doing, having convenience stops. But I don't think we'll be the forefront of that. I think we'll be the adopter of that. And so from my standpoint, if I want to have a generational family business that is, as you said, looking for the next disruption, then I probably have got to be aware and educate our employees, myself, on looking for other areas of opportunity. And look at to the entrepreneurial side, not so much saying it has to be within the petroleum world.
Yeah, we have time for just two or three more questions, and I want to build on that. You were at Harvard Business School. Another famous Harvard professor is Clayton Christensen, famous for writing the book The Innovator's Dilemma. And you're absolutely right. It's hard to diversify out of your core business when you're doing it. How do you create a culture at FJ Management to encourage the right amount of looking outside of the core business?
You know, I think that you would almost want to do that, at least in our case, outside of the operating businesses to some degree, because you definitely have people, and I would argue that Maverick within our industry, the convenience store industry, is extremely innovative. And we do encourage innovation within Maverick when it comes to food service and merchandising and branding. I really believe, and I'm very proud, that we are some of the best innovators, if not the best innovating convenience store chain that's out there. So I would never want to go to the people at Maverick, say, who I think are amazing innovators, and say, figure out what we do in another industry someplace else, right? So that it is a challenge, and I think about that every day. I try to encourage people to feel comfortable and build a culture to bring their ideas forward. And we have had people bring ideas, and we are exploring ideas for businesses and things brought by our employees. But it is, sometimes it's two different things to run a business and have people focused and going all the same direction and trying to innovate and disrupt at the same time.
I think that's wise. In fact, a friend of mine, Josh Grostein, I think is on the side of your business that's not in the operating side,
right,
but really part of his job is thinking about
business development. Actually,
business development,
yes.
Think about what's coming next,
right?
That kind of stuff. Again, just one or two more questions. We talked about the influence your father had on the way you look at business, the way you look at life. Obviously, your mom and dad, huge impact on the person you are today. What do you hope that your kids have learned from you, from your experiences?
I hope they've learned that they need to be their own people, and that the most important thing that I can give, and I can't even give, that they can develop for themselves is self-confidence, and that they do the right thing and they're honest in all their dealings. Because fundamentally, if you don't have integrity, I believe at some point it will catch up with you. Or it's not fun. The wake of being a person that takes advantage of people or has a huge ego is just, it's not pretty. So that's what I want for my kids.
That's a great thing for them to take away. It's also a great note for us to wrap up on. Crystal, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thank you.
Our guest this morning has been Crystal Call McGullett, and she is the CEO and president of FJ Management, Inc. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You can hear our entire interview with Crystal on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Bottom Line podcast. You can tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.